For the week of January 20th, 2013, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 178, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. Attending the Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York City, I'm Michael Giltz. So, Sperling, how are you doing? You're out at Sundance?
Yes, I wonder if it's colder in New York than in Park City.
It will be tomorrow. It's going to be in the low 20s tomorrow's the high, so I'm bracing myself for the cold weather.
Ah, okay. Well, so how are things going in New York? I mean, this sounds like we're doing small talk here, but
well,
really,
we are. It's the opening banter. Things are fine. We're looking forward to hearing about Sundance. What else are we going to hear about on the show today?
Well, actually, I guess on today's show, we don't have a guest because I'm traveling, so I suppose I'll be the special guest so that we can discuss this year's Sundance Film Festival. And we'll try and make it a short show this week. We can go over some of the films that have caused a stir, the general mood here at this year's festival, and I don't know, like the weather, which, by the way, often affects the general mood here at Sundance. And it's been relatively warm, and it's been a relatively warm festival, literally, in figuratively, and well, you know what I mean. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines, which, you know, there weren't too many of them this week. It's January, maybe the year is gearing up. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
All right, well, we have our patented worldwide box office, the only people that bother to figure out what movies have grossed all around the world this past week. And the number one movie around the world is Quentin Tarantino's Django Unchained. It opened wide in Europe this week, and including some other territories. It made $56 million. It's at $180 million worldwide. No, it must be $190 million worldwide. No, that includes North America. I beg your pardon. It's $180 million worldwide and counting. It's mostly opened in North America, where it's already Tarantino's highest grossing film of all time. I already have my Dr. King Schultz doll, which is a great. It's on my shelf already. I'm very excited by it, but we'll get more to that later.
Well, wait a second. Did you open the packaging on that doll? That action figure?
No. I kept it secured. The Christoph Waltz Dr. King Schultz character, keep it in its original packaging because that's the way you collect.
That's right. If you're an action figure collector, you never break the blister pack for Star Wars figures. And in this case, it comes in a box, the Django Unchained action figures. But we'll talk more about that at the end of the show.
At number two around the world is a horror film, Mama, grossing $29 million worldwide. It stars Jessica Chastain, who's also in Zero Dark Thirty. So this is the biggest week of her life, right? Really. Zero Dark Thirty's gone wide a week ago. It's up for a lot of Oscars. She's winning awards. She's hoping she's going to win an Oscar. And she's also in a commercial film like Mama, which is a horror flick. Did not get great reviews, but did not get the blistering reviews that a lot of horror films often get. And frankly, I think that helps her at the Oscars. People who are voting see her in another movie that's commercial. It shouldn't affect it, but in a way, no, she's a star. She's not just an actress who was in a good movie. She's also opening other films and proving a draw at the box office. That helps you. Oscar voters like winners.
Yeah, I mean, could you imagine being, I don't know how old Jessica Chastain is. I probably should have looked that up, but she's young. She may even be under 30. And can you imagine 2 years into your career, you are in the number one and number two film in a given week? I mean, and those films have made what? So nearly $50 million in one weekend? That's pretty amazing.
She's 35 years old. She'll be 36 in March, but I don't know why I say it's 2 years into her career.
Well, okay.
She's been making movies since she was on ER in 2004.
Okay, you know what I mean.
No, I don't.
Okay, well, I was hoping you knew what I meant so that I didn't have to explain what I meant, but I guess what I'm saying is 2 years into her rise to stardom.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what happened. That's what a rise to stardom means. At number three around the world is a film that's turned a digital tiger into a star. It's Life of Pi, Ang Lee's film based on the best-selling novel. It grossed $28 million around the world. It's just under $500 million worldwide to date.
You know, that digital Bengal tiger is going to be impossible to work with from now on.
At number, he'll bite you. Yeah. Ah, get it?
Bite. I got it. Yes.
At number, I sound like you. I'm playing in the role of Sperling today. It's Michael Giltz. At number four around the world is the musical Les Miserables. It grossed another $27 million worldwide. It's at $280 million and counting. At number five, The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey, the first part of three movies to tell the story of a 300-page children's novel. It grossed $20 million worldwide. It's at $920 million and counting. This film will almost certainly, I think, hit $1 billion worldwide. So I think we're looking at a Twilight effect here. I think the three Hobbit films, my guess is they all gross around $900 to $1 billion.
Wow.
And number six is Zero Dark Thirty, the Jessica Chastain film, which is wide for the second week. It's also opening up a little bit overseas. It grossed $18 million. It's at $60 million and counting. It has a big campaign ahead of it. At number seven is Gangster Squad, the L.A. cops fighting crime period drama that was a bust with critics and audiences, frankly. It grossed $15 million worldwide. It's at $51 million and counting. And number eight is Jack Reacher, a Tom Cruise film. It grossed $14 million. It's at $175 million and counting. It cost $60 million to make.
Well, so, and Paramount said last week that they will not be making a sequel to this film, even though Jack Reacher is based on a very popular series of books, not just one, but there's a whole...
They said they wouldn't unless it grossed four times its budget. So they're looking for $240 million, which is not necessarily out of the question yet.
Okay.
And the reason they want four times a rather modest budget is because Tom Cruise gets a lot of money. He gets first dollar gross. He's sucking up the money, and that's fine. But I think it's really edging towards where, you know, if they get over $200 million, I think they're going to, and they will, I think they're seriously going to have to reconsider and think about, you know, they've launched a film. As long as he doesn't go crazy with his demands on the budget for the second film, I think it's well worth pulling the trigger for another Jack Reacher film. And like you say, it's a very popular novel series. So they've got a lot of properties ready to develop. If not, maybe they turn it into a TV series.
Well, and maybe they get another person to star in it. You know, they did that with The Hunt for Red October. They had Alec Baldwin.
Well, there's a million movies where they've done that.
Right, where they changed the lead character. James Bond, for instance.
Yeah, I don't think Tom Cruise, you know, I don't think pulling him out of a movie when he helps you gross three times overseas what you do in North America is definitely a smart move to make.
Well, okay.
But, you know, number nine is two films tied at $10 million. Wreck-It Ralph, the animated film, that's at $355 million. And The Impossible, the film about the tsunami starring Ewan McGregor, it's at $116 million worldwide. And number 11, a North American debut, which was pretty disappointing, Broken City, a political drama starring Russell Crowe and Mark Wahlberg, it grossed $9 million. And then at number 12 are three films tied at $8 million worldwide. The horror spoof, A Haunted House, which is at $30 million and counting. Parental Guidance, the Billy Crystal Bette Midler movie, which is just about to hit $100 million worldwide. And Lincoln, the Steven Spielberg film, which is now at $164 million worldwide and counting. It's just starting to open up overseas, and it's still pulling in money in North America. And number 15 is a movie that opened up overseas 1 week before it opens up here. Hansel and Gretel, The Witch Hunters. It grossed $7 million worldwide, essentially all of it in Russia. And they made a big point of telling us that 93% of ticket sales were in 3D. Okay. Which makes me wonder how many screenings were available to see Hansel and Gretel in Russia in 2D.
I don't know. That's a good question.
I would guess virtually none.
Yeah.
And number 16 is the really big news, I think, for the box office this week. Arnold Schwarzenegger and Johnny Knoxville in The Last Stand. It opened at number 10 in North America, number 16 around the world. It grossed $6 million in its opening weekend. It is a sad, sad return to the movies for former Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yes, that is true. And former box office star Arnold Schwarzenegger. I mean, I think you had me not seeing this movie at Arnold Schwarzenegger and Johnny Knoxville. Right there, I'm already thinking, I don't want to see this movie.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I had no interest. And when I saw the trailer way back at CinemaCon, I just thought, oh, this movie, what are they thinking? But I guess, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger has a name. He had a bigger name in the 80s and 90s. And now, you know, he's disappeared. He disappeared for like 8 years.
Well, he was... Well, he's got two more movies already in the can. The Tomb, which also stars... Sylvester Stallone, and a movie called 10, in which he stars. It's David Ayer, the guy who wrote Training Day, and the pretty well-reviewed movie End of Days. This is another, you know, a cop film. So that's David Ayer's, you know, wheelhouse. So we'll have to see how that is. And he has a couple other movies in the works, like a potential Conan, a potential Terminator, a couple other things, Triplets. But they've been sort of simmering on the back burner for a while. But this won't be the last from Arnold. This movie didn't click. It came out in January, which probably shows not a lot of confidence in it. But he'll be back.
Yeah, I mean, it literally came in the U.S. It came in 10th. So,
and we got that's pretty dreadful. We got a fair amount of information about the box office overseas, a breakdown of country by country, which countries sent back the most money to Hollywood. That is, not how big their box office was, but how well the Hollywood studios did in those countries. Around the world, if you look at them, what are the biggest markets for American films? The number one market is the UK and Ireland. I guess that's how to describe it. The United Kingdom and Ireland. The Hollywood pulled out $1.4 billion from that market alone.
No, overall, is that profit? Is that net? Or is that's what the film's grossed?
That's what they grossed.
Okay, just checking. Okay,
obviously. And we know that studios don't get back every penny. Some of it goes to the exhibitors, the distributing company, etc.
Right.
But their movies did gross $1.4 billion in that market. The entire market is $1.9 billion. So they took out 75% of all the money grossed in the UK and Ireland. It was for a Hollywood film.
Yeah, in Europe, that's about the average, between 75% and 85% is Hollywood content.
Well, China has been very dominant in the local market. China has a lot of films that they put out that we don't ever see, just like India. Their total market value is $2.7 billion. That's how much movies grossed in China in 2012. $1 billion of that went to the major Hollywood studios.
Which is, that's significant.
Yeah, because that market didn't exist 10 years ago. You'd get to release 3 films a year and they'd keep all the money.
Right. And they still kind of keep all the money, but they're working on that.
That's right.
Speaking of keeping all the money, in third place you have Russia.
Right, yeah. Russia, then Mexico, which is a bit of a surprise for me. Yeah, that is so high up.
Oh, no, France. Latin America, they are on fire. Brazil is on fire. Like, you know, I think they were up 64% in Brazil as far as their box office goes.
Brazil's in the top 10. It goes Mexico, then France, then Germany, Australia, Japan, Brazil, and Korea. I thought Japan would be higher up, but you can see there's a lot of growth around the world. These numbers are all up from previous years. So Hollywood movies are still packing them in. And of course, some of the movies that will be scoring big at the box office a year or two from now, they hope, will be screening right now in Sundance. At least that's the hope of the directors and the producers behind them.
Wow, you are playing me today. That was a great segue.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
So you're in Sundance. I've never been. Where do you stay?
Well, funny you should ask that, because I am staying at the Marriott Mountainside, which is up in the Park City Mountain Resort. You know, ski in, ski out, as they say. And I don't ski at all, so I'm not skiing. But I was only here. I was only able to book 1 week, and the festival crosses 2 weeks. So the first couple of days, I was staying in what I like to call the Sundance Big Brother house. I found somebody on Craigslist who was renting out beds in a condo, and it was a whole bunch of people who didn't know each other. Some were filmmakers. There was a guy there who works for Saturday Night Live making their films, and he was here to speak on a panel. And it was this revolving kind of clientele or house guests. And people were coming in at all hours of the night. Nobody knew anybody, so you didn't, like, leave your computer there. It was really very frat house-like.
I'm proud to say that my first thought was George Orwell when you said Big Brother, but you actually referring to the TV show Big Brother. That's very funny. You're all sort of thrown together into this tank and have to survive with each other.
Right. I was looking for the confessional booth.
Did you pay for that place?
Oh, it was $100 a night.
That's not so bad. How many people did he scram into the apartment?
It was a woman who I did not meet at all. Actually, who stayed there.
She wouldn't want to be there with all you people.
No, she stayed there. And I think, I don't know, that at one point there were like 12 people there. At least.
So $100 a night?
Yeah.
So 12 people, she pulled in $1,200 that one night alone?
Probably, yeah.
This is her home?
No. She's a filmmaker and she runs a festival in Hawaii and, you know, she's...
So she rented the place and then sublet it?
Pretty much, yeah. She was trying to, you know, not have to pay for the entire condo herself.
Wow. She couldn't get away with that at Cannes. It would be really hard.
No, because the places aren't as big. There's not enough room. I mean, this was a pretty big place.
Wow. Okay, so she was subbing. Now you're at the Marriott. How much are you paying there a night?
I haven't even calculated it. I think it's...
Wow, you must be rich.
No. It's not... Let's put it this way. I am, again, subletting... this is one of those, like, timeshare-type places, so I'm subletting the studio portion of a two-bedroom condo. So
now, how far are you from the festival? Can you walk to the festival? Do you have to take a public transportation, or what do you do?
Yeah, well, Sundance, that's actually one of the problems that Sundance has, is that it's in Park City, Utah, which is an old mining town in Utah, about 30 minutes east of Salt Lake City. So it's very accessible by car as far as getting here. But once you're here, they may as well call it no park city because there's no place to park. If you rent a car.
You don't have a car, obviously.
No. But and those that do and park them often find that they get towed by the town itself.
So how do you get around?
Well, for years they had problems with people getting around, but now they have these shuttle buses that are both put in place for the festival and ones that run all the time here in Park City. And they just do all these loops around the town and out to
So how far do you have to walk to get to a shuttle stop?
Me, not very far. Not very, but then you might have to wait 30, 40 minutes sometimes, for a shuttle to the place you're going. Other times you can walk to where you're going, depending on how cold it is. I find at night, the shuttles get a little bit more crowded.
Hmm. So you're able to walk to everything that you need to if you chose?
No.
It's not that, or is it really untenable?
It would be untenable.
Oh, okay. So now, how many people are there this year? What's it seem like? Does it feel like a rebound commercially? Are there a lot of people there? Is there a lot of activity? What's the atmosphere?
Well, you know, in the past, like, 3 years, they've called it, like, Recession Sundance. There were hardly any people here. And by hardly any people, I mean, like, okay, there were 35 to 40,000 people instead of 50,000 people.
Right. It was crammed full. It just wasn't insane.
Right. It's like you could breathe. You just couldn't breathe that well. Now, again, I think I wouldn't be shocked if you said that there were 45 to 55,000 people here this week, though it does not feel as crowded as it did, say, in 2003, 2004 during, you know, the big height of the swag era.
Mm-hmm. Is there a sense of excitement? People are happy to see how well Beasts of the Southern Wild did commercially and critically. Is there a sense that Sundance has some mojo again?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I have seen more buyers at the press and industry screenings, and there were always buyers and acquisitions executives, and by that I mean the people for Fox Searchlight and Focus Features and Millennium Entertainment and Relativity. But notice I'm mentioning names that you wouldn't have mentioned 7 years ago. 5 years
right.
ago.
And, well, that's always the way it is with the indie world. Companies come and go. They always have. Orion is no longer with us. I mean, it's just the way of the world.
Right, but now there are more of them, and there are more people out there looking for films because they're not going to pay to make a movie because that's too risky, but they'll pay to buy a movie because you can actually see the finished product and know whether it's going to turn out.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's exciting. So Sundance is always an important venue. But there were a number of years where Sundance did not have a lot of excitement around it. It felt like the big movies were not scoring at the box office. You know, they would win the Sundance, but they weren't capitalized on it. There's obviously a lot of documentaries that come out of the festival. But the coverage has always been intense. It has to be the most covered festival in North America.
I
don't think anything else comes close.
I would agree with you wholeheartedly.
I mean, I know Toronto's big. I know others big. But Sundance just gets a huge crush of coverage.
I agree. I think in part it's because so many people have access to it.
Right. They can go. They can't go to Cannes. They don't go to Toronto, but they can go to Sundance.
Right. And there's 1,001 bloggers up here. I mean, I actually noticed this year. I was looking around, going, "Wow, I recognize some of these people, but a lot of these people, like when I first started coming to this festival, they weren't around."
So where do they file? Where do they do their stories? Is there a press conference press room?
Is there a press center?
A million little cafes with Wi-Fi hotspots?
It's more the latter.
Yeah? There's no central place where people could bump into each other like you see at a con?
Well, like the Marriott Park City, which is kind of more in the city itself, is the festival headquarters. So the festival headquarters are at another Marriott. And you could sit down in that Marriott, but there's not a lot of space to sit down in that Marriott. Maybe you could fit 300 people if you're lucky in various corners.
So there's no heart of the festival in that sense?
Not really, no. The Eccles, no. I mean, you know, there's one big giant theater. The Egyptian Theater on Main Street is considered the heart of the festival. But the reality is it's, you know, it is what it is. There is no Cannes. There is no big Palais as there is in Cannes.
So it's like Toronto where you see people at screenings, but you don't always bump into them every day at a certain area or location.
That is 100% correct, yeah.
And what are the screenings like? Is it hard to get in this year? Do you have levels of badges? You know, what's it like? Is it a smooth process or is there still a frenzy and it's really hard if a movie gets really popular?
Well, it does become hard if a movie gets really popular. Like the press screening for Breathe In, because it had premiered, I think, a day or two earlier and the buzz had already started, It got sold out, and I think towards the end of the festival, more and more of the present industry screenings begin to get sold out. Although toward the end of the festival, more and more people go home, so it kind of thins out the press corps.
Breathe In is the film starring Guy Pearce and Felicity Jones. It's by Drake Doremus, wrote and directed it. Co-wrote and directed it, I should say. Is that, when you say they're sold out, does that mean, do they do a lot of multiple screenings of movies? Like, will Breathe In screen again towards the end of the festival and you'll have a second chance to catch it?
Yes, exactly. So when a film premieres here, really they're saying the film's first screening is on a specific day at a specific time. But then there might be five other screenings, including the breast screening. So it might.
And how early, if you wanted to show up and see Breathe In, how early would you have to show up for the next time it shows?
Well,
half an hour, 20 minutes, an hour?
In that regard, the press and industry screening you get, and you asked about levels of badges, and I think anybody, people who've been to a film festival, they give badges out usually to the press corps, members of the press, and there are levels. So Time Magazine might get a higher or more exclusive or more access type badge than, say, Joe Blow's blog. And I don't mean joeblow.com. I just mean, just some.
So like the best badge has like a Butch and Sundance picture on the cover, and the worst badge has like a Havana cover from Robert Redford's Havana, something like that.
I would say the LA Times, the New York Times, I saw MSN, and the Village Voice, they get what's called Press Express, and you can just pretty much walk into any public screening. Doesn't matter whether it's press or industry, or you just walk in.
And what do you have?
I have a general press, which is a pretty good badge, and you can go to all the print and industry screenings, and you can also request tickets to public screenings. So you have to go back to the press office every day to request one or two tickets to a public screening of a film you may not have been able to catch.
Maybe this isn't fair, but I think at other festivals, the lectures and the roundtables and all those sort of things are sort of an afterthought. To me, they're just not that important. I'm at Cannes to see movies. I'm at Toronto to see movies. But I feel like Sundance has, because of the Institute and the screenplay, they have a lot of mentoring programs and scholarships, and they're helping people get their short film made and their documentary short made. And they really nurture artists in a lot of different levels. And I feel like somehow, even though I've never attended one, that their lectures and conferences and roundtables and all that stuff, I think they're a much more important part of the festival. Is that true, or am I just making that up?
Actually, it is true. I mean, there are, because it's not just Sundance that's holding panels. There are Slam Dance panels. Slam Dance is another festival taking place at the same time. There are companies that come up here, like Adobe, that hold panels on their own. There are filmmaker groups that come up here and hold panel discussions during the same period of time. So you're absolutely right. The reason that you hear so much about the different panels is because not everybody has access to the screenings, so they go to panels. And because Sundance doesn't, they'll put on maybe 5 to 10 panels, well, other companies and other groups can come up here and hold their own panels, and that's exactly what they do.
Now, we know that there are movies that are hot and people are talking about, but what's the buzz? What are the topics that are people talking about? They don't talk about 3D at Sundance, obviously, I assume. They talk about digital. They talk about those sort of technical issues, or what's on people's mind?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, most of the Sundance panels this year are on, 4K and how digital filmmaking is, digital technology is changing filmmaking and the types of films being made, which, we discussed last week about, how it's making films longer in length, the running time longer. And I would say, I can't remember whether it's the third or fourth year that John Cooper is the director of the festival. It used to be Jeffrey Gilmore, who went off to Tribeca and is now the head of the Tribeca Film Festival, or the artistic director there. Now Trevor Groth and John Cooper and a team of programmers have taken it over, and it's become, in my opinion, far lighter. And I don't mean that in any negative way. What I mean by that is the films are a little bit more commercial. They lean a little bit more toward a comedic sense or a lighter subject matter. You get a Lynn Shelton movie as opposed to a Darren Aronofsky movie. Although then I say that, but then you had Beasts of the Southern Wild last year. So, I think that there are just more films like
the mix is just a little more appealing and widely appealing.
Yes, exactly. It's and the documentaries, as always, are fantastic, very timely. There's a documentary, a collaborative film about the Occupy movement. There's a film that Robert Reich, the former Secretary of the Treasury, is in. That is,
it's a short, I imagine,
because he's short. I get it. It's called Inequality for All, and it's about income disparity and how it's growing and how that's affecting the United States. There was a film that I saw called The World of Dick Cheney, made by R.J. Cutler.
But that's not an outsider portrayal. That's sort of a one of a group of films about political figures by people close to them. It's not a challenging documentary, is it?
Well, no. I mean, it was R.J. Cutler, so he's not close to Cheney at all. In fact, there are some moments there that don't make him look very good. But it's more of an even balanced approach. But it doesn't tell you anything you didn't already know. There was nothing there where you went, oh, wow, that's a revelation. It's like, oh, okay, if you read his book and you read the coverage of Cheney's book and Bush's book and you kind of stayed up with the news over the past 10 years, you pretty much knew everything. There was nothing earth-shattering. I haven't seen the Chasing Ice of this year, meaning that the Chasing Ice was the film about how the glaciers are melting and how this photographer caught them or documented the disappearance of the glaciers using cameras and that took a picture once every hour or two during the day.
Oh, over a period of years.
Over a period project. Of years, yes. And a fantastic, phenomenal documentary last year, as was The Queen of Versailles, about a Hollywood couple that were billionaires.
Which did not deliver at the box office.
Yes, did not deliver at the box office at all, even though it was a great film. The one documentary I saw where I could kind of point and say, hey, yeah, I like that, was When I Walk, which it's a film about the filmmaker, actually. He's in his 20s. I think he's 25. And he gets MS in 2006. He's diagnosed with MS. Jason De Silva is his name. He was a documentary and is a documentary filmmaker. And he documents the next 5 years of his life, you know, how he progresses with MS. And he goes from walking and talking and having his first MS encounter or moment with muscular sclerosis on camera just by accident. You know, his brother was filming him and he kind of fell down and couldn't get up, and all the way through to current day where he can't walk and can barely talk. And it's a very moving film, but of course, like MS, which doesn't have a cure, it doesn't leave you with, there's no story necessarily. There's no ending to the story, I guess is the best way to put that.
There's no happy ending. Is that what you mean?
Well, not even a happy ending, but there's no resolution. But, you know, Sundance has always been very timely. There's a film up here called Blue Caprice, which is a fictional take by Alexandra Moores about the DC sniper event. And that's in the next section. So there's different sections. There's U.S. competition, dramatic competition. There's the U.S. documentary competition, and the same thing for world and international films. And the next series of films, or track, if you will, is micro-budget films. And this film kind of follows the DC snipers. It's a character study of the father and son, and as we know now, they weren't necessarily father and son, about how the father brainwashed this young boy into going on this killing spree. And based on real events.
Well, that does sound light.
Yeah, well, that one wasn't light.
You're also doing business there. Can you talk about any of the business meetings or what you're dealing with or covering at the festival? I mean, you're obviously an expert in digital technology and the sending of films digitally, which is a huge technical issue that is a constant challenge as far as they keep updating the formats and standards and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, and I would say most of the, really what we're hearing now is that we're reaching an age where, because the technology is not 100 years old and can't be had in every cinema equipment store or by, you know, from every cinema equipment vendor, a lot of these art houses, a lot of these independent theaters, they're going to have to turn nonprofit. They're just not going to be able to survive on selling movie tickets alone.
You're saying one or two screen theaters or any nonprofit or any art house film? You think like IFC and Angelica can't survive? Or are you talking about the one screeners and the two screeners around the country and the globe?
Yes, the latter, the one screener, two screener.
And so much like we talk about independent bookstores and how they are sort of trying to raise money on Kickstarter to stay alive, and they're becoming actually nonprofits. They're turning into nonprofit companies and saying, we just want to be a community center. You feel like if you're trying to show movies in film, you know, we want to project a movie in film, and you're going to be dealing with art house films and smaller films, and just trying to get a print is going to be harder and harder in years to come. If you're one of those people, if you're going to survive at all, it may be as a nonprofit if you're lucky.
Right. And as a cultural institution, one artistic director from a one such venue in Michigan said, you know, really, we are going to become the cultural curators for motion pictures in our area. That we will be
just like there's a museum for painting and photography.
Right.
There, if you're lucky, you'll have a movie theater that can show film on film.
That is, or that can show films even on digital cinema. But to afford the equipment to show digital cinema, they might have to do a Kickstarter campaign or ask for contributions as opposed to just ticket prices.
And they won't be necessarily a commercial house. Do they think they're all just going to have to become Revival houses, or do they think there's some sort of combination of Revival and new? Or
I think they're looking more at showing films that wouldn't otherwise be seen, much like a museum might show artists that you've never heard of, along with Picasso. But, you know, they are curators of the culture, both past and present.
Nonprofits, those museums, can have really unexpected hits. For example, at MoMA right now is a film called The Clock. It's not even a film, it's more of an installation, but it's 24 hours in length. And what it is it compiles clips from movies all over the world. Any movie where you show a minute or a second on like a watch face or a clock on the wall or a grandfather clock or a dashboard of a car, they went through every movie they could find and pulled together clips to show time. And they basically have a clip for every minute of the day. In fact, even down to the seconds of every minute of the day. So you're looking at this compilation film, which lasts for 24 hours and has like every minute of the day, a clicking clock. It sounds like this weird little art installation. It has been a sold out, you can't get in line phenomenon. Over the weekend, they showed it for 24-hour cycles. So from Friday night to Monday morning, they showed this film on a continuous loop. It's 24 hours in length, mind you.
Yeah, that's kind of a huge loop.
So they stayed open for 24 hours over the weekend, you know, 24 hours a day. And there were lines at 10 at night of a 2-hour wait to get into MoMA so you could sit down and watch this movie.
You know, this is a film called The Clock. Or is it The Clocks? I can't remember. But it was here at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art in Los Angeles and was a huge hit here. They're bringing it back. That's how much of a hit it was.
And I'm like, what? Just somebody put it in a movie theater. I want to go see it, but it's impossible.
Right. And they did the same thing where you couldn't, the access was constrained and they would do these like 24-hour
runs. Much seating.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. You know, I get it. I mean, yeah, I mean, exactly. And I think that, you know, that is a thematic film. And I think, I know you hate it when I look for themes at festivals, whether it be Cannes or Sundance or Toronto, it doesn't matter. But I have to say, this year, on Saturday morning, I went to see, at the Eccles, the big theater here at Sundance, Don John's Addiction. Now, this stars your boy that you like.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt, a very talented actor.
Right, and he wrote and directed this film about a guy in his 20s.
And stars.
Yeah, he stars in it as this kind of Don Juan guy from Jersey who is...
He loves porn.
He loves the porn. And but then he meets Scarlett Johansson, who does a great job as a Jersey girl, I have to say. And it got bashed the day before I saw it by one of the trades. But I saw it, and everybody loved it. It's a really fun film. It was picked up by Relativity, so it will be seen. I don't know how they're going to rate that movie, but it was really – and he was very thoughtful, and he's a fine filmmaker.
You thought it was very well directed. It's an NC-17 type film. Is that what you say?
No, actually, I wouldn't be surprised. It's a hard R, that's for sure.
Yeah, because they show clips, but they don't show all of them. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and they kind of punch into most of the clips. But, you know, it stars Julianne Moore as well. And Tony Danza makes a good case for a comeback in this film. But, you know, I wanted to, you know, during the Q&A, I wanted to say, hey, Joey G, what's wrong with Jersey? Because he talks that way throughout the whole film.
Well, you'll be able to follow us up next week on the rest of the festival. I don't know if Wes Anderson
has
ever...
Wait a second. Before we go off on that, I just wanted to... The whole concept of theme...
I'm sorry.
The next day, there was a film... I can't even remember the name of it, but it was... It's a premiere. It was a Michael Winterbottom film, which, as you know, Michael... What's the best way to describe Michael Winterbottom?
Iconoclastic?
Okay.
Talented?
Yeah, I mean, but sometimes his stories don't always pan out, I suppose. This film is called The Look of Love, and it stars Steve Coogan as the true story of a British adult magazine publisher and entrepreneur, Paul Raymond. And the story wasn't all that great. So I just thought, wait a second, I'm seeing Don John's Addiction one day at 9 o'clock in the morning, and then on Sunday I'm seeing this the look of love at 9 o'clock in the morning. It's like Sundance has become the, you know, porn in the morn festival.
Well, you would have loved working at a newspaper or magazine in the 80s and 90s, because if you saw two things like that, they would say, ah, find one more and you've got a box. It's a trend. You know, you just need, you can do a little graphic and say, ah, the trend of films with pornography. And there you go.
Well, so you know, James Franco is up here and he has this underground leather bar movie, which is another sex film. And he said, you know, effectively paraphrasing, sex films are the new black.
Okay.
So,
well, I don't know. Obviously, next week you'll catch us up on the finale of Sundance. I don't know if Wes Anderson has ever actually had a film at Sundance. I somehow don't think he has, even though he's in very much in the spirit of independent cinema. But I came across, I got an email about his screenplay, which is nominated for an Oscar, of course, from Moonrise Kingdom. He co-wrote it. And I thought this was clever. They sent a link to the script posted online with a sort of an interactive display. You've got photos from the shoot, you've got stills from the movie, you've got sketches and ideas for sets and costumes and all that sort of stuff mixed in with the screenplay. So it's sort of a nice interactive screenplay, and it's posted online. Anyone can look at it. We've got the script link posted on our website, and it's a pretty clever idea of getting people to look at your script and think about your script and how that leads to the film. I mean, if I had one nominated for an Oscar, I'd put mine up, you know, anything to bring it a little attention. This seemed like a very smart idea.
Do you think it's kind of a smart move? Well, I guess you do think it's a smart move, but do you think it will actually help him win the Academy Award?
No, I don't think it's going to help you necessarily win, but it gives you an edge. I think it's a help. Yes, I don't think it means he's going to win. I mean, he's in the best original screenplay, right?
Best
adapted is clearly Lincoln, Tony Kushner. Best original screenplay is more of an up in the air thing, but you know, it doesn't hurt. I don't think this is his year, so I don't think he'll win. But it brings attention to your script and reminds people of how movies begin. It's all words on a page at one point.
Well, so it's kind of a big deal, but not really.
Exactly. It's a big deal.
Okay, so then it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, well,
I love this.
Yes, Universal announced that the highly anticipated Jurassic Park 4, to which I say, they only have four of them? It feels like they've had like 50 of them. Well, they're finally getting a release date for Jurassic Park 4. The latest film in the blockbuster franchise will hit theaters on June 13th, 2014, right in the heart of the summer season, and so far, it has the prime release date to itself. That will probably change. The last Jurassic Park came out in 2001, so kids that were born in 2001 will be 14 when this movie comes out? Pretty interesting.
13,
okay. Well, that film was a relative flop. The first film grossed $923 million worldwide, the second $786 million worldwide, and the third a paltry $365 million. But since the last only cost a reported, I think it was like $93 million, that's plenty and enough time has passed that people might be interested in seeing it again. So they've got the release date and, you know, possibly even the audience anticipation. So what's missing from this formula, Michael? Oh, wait. I think I got it. A director, a cast, and a finished screenplay. But they do know when it's coming out. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal because it's a big deal of idiocy, as always. Why you would greenlight this movie when you've had 11 years, 12 years to work on the script, and you don't have a script that you're ready with yet? Why you would suddenly say, we have to get it out by this date in 2014? It's moronic. It could come out Christmas 2014, summer 20. It doesn't matter.
Well, you know,
it's going to make money. You know, it can make money. You need to get a script. Then you decide whether you want to make the movie.
Well, I think that when, you know, all of these big studios are part of large conglomerates now, and they look at these movies as product.
They like steady progress. I understand. They like, yeah, a steady stream of revenue. They like a steady stream of movies locked in. But you lock in a movie after you have a screenplay. You don't lock it in before. That's a recipe for disaster. The point is not that they can't plan in advance. The point is not that they can't do all sorts of things and keep franchises and dumb movies. I don't like Transformers. Of course, they're going to greenlight another Transformers film. But the smart way to do it is not, you're not just churning out another Ford Fiesta. It's creating an entirely new product from scratch. You better have your blueprint done before you decide to build the product.
Right, and I think rather than looking at a screenplay as a part of the manufacturing process, they should really begin looking at it as a part of the
research and development.
Yes, exactly, because I think they're looking at it as, well, that's just one thing that we need to build this product. No, it's not a widget. It is your blueprint. And if you don't have that.
That's a very good comparison, that you've got to do the research and development to decide what product you want to make before you can actually decide to make the product. You're like, I want to make product X.
There are a lot of people out there that would say, hey, these guys are full of it. Not every film has a release date before a script, but it seems to be happening more and more.
Absolutely.
Now, the new season of American Idol launched, and the news is, well, it's good for Fox. The opening show was down almost 20% from the premiere in 2012, despite the addition of three new hosts, and those new hosts are Keith Urban, Nicki Minaj, and Mariah Carey.
But catfight.
That's true. The second night, however, it was virtually identical to 1 year earlier, down only a tenth of a point, and it was steady in most of the demographic categories. And even the premiere episode that was down from the season before was still 41% higher than, say, The Voice in key demographics. Idol was drawing 16 million to 18 million viewers this first week, and the big numbers start rolling in, when all those live performances start. It may be hard to stay number two behind football, let's say, but by the way, Michael, I know you know this. There are some shows that are just surging now in the ratings. The Big Bang Theory and NCIS are both hitting 20 million at a time, but Idol still looks like it's the number one reality show on TV. Big deal or big what, Michael?
Well, I think it's a big deal. I know Fox said, we're thrilled, we're excited. Of course, they would have liked somehow that the new judges sent the ratings skyrocketing, with the curiosity factor. But, it is the granddaddy of these talent competitions. It has a lot of, competitors out there, from the X Factor to The Voice, double-barreled, fall and spring. So that starts up again in March with new judges. So, it's down, but it's still $16, $18 million view. It's top five. And they got to be thrilled. It's 11 years into this show's run. That's what happens to a show. It drops from its peak. The fact that it's still fighting to be the number one reality show in the country is kind of amazing. And what really matters are the talent, the kids, the auditions, the people that they find. The first few weeks when they keep creating stars, and that's what Idol does better than all the others, their winners actually have success, right down to the guy from last season, the season before. You're seeing them all over the place. Phillip Phillips and Scotty McCreery. Phillip Phillips has a top 10 single. Scotty McCreery has been all over the place in the country world. So they're still producing actual stars, which is something The Voice and The X Factor can't even begin to pretend.
There's a film up here at Sundance, not to go back to that subject, but there's a film, I saw it on the first day here, 20 Feet from Stardom, and it's all about backup singers, Darlene Love and all of these backup singers that sing with the Rolling Stones and Bruce Springsteen.
Well, Darlene Love was a backup singer way, I don't know if,
they
I don't
go,
know if she ever.
They go way, mean, way, way back to the 50s.
I mean,
40s.
But she had a big career as a lead singer, obviously.
That's right, and they talk about how she transitioned into being her own.
Ah, okay.
And they even talk about calling the backup singer out for, I'm trying to remember the name. It's Just a Shot Away, the Rolling Stones song. I can't remember the name of it. I can sing it, but I can't remember.
Oh, I wish you would.
Oh, please, trust me. And they called her up, and he sings this duet with her. I think it's just Take Shelter, maybe?
Uh-huh, but that's a song, yeah.
And the stories are just amazing. But they interview Sting, and he talks about how the difference between a backup singer and somebody from American Idol, the backup singer spends years honing their voice so that they're an instrument. Whereas somebody who's in American Idol, their talent may be very wafer thin. I thought that
that's moronic. That's idiotic. That just shows he's never watched American Idol and doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. There are people who have years of talent in the industry who then go on to a talent show like the American Idol to try and get a breakthrough. There have been backup singers who've toured with major stars like Michael Jackson and other people and then gone on to Idol, and they haven't necessarily won. But there's people on those shows like anybody anywhere. Some are very talented, some are not at all. But to say that if you're on a reality show trying to gain a contract that you're untalented and have no training or skill is stupid.
Well, and he may not have.
Sting is just being an idiot.
Well, okay. Title of the show: Sting is an idiot. But let's move on to.
And he's a terrific. I've never seen him in concert, and I really would like to.
He's great.
Just
in
a
concert.
Bummer for me. I don't know why I've missed him, but I've never seen him.
And that movie, by the way, 20 Feet from Stardom, great movie. In any case,
That sounds good. Yeah.
The people behind the Star Wars multiplayer online game, The Old Republic, managed to annoy, just about everyone when they introduced some limited flexibility in the sexual orientation of its characters. The option to choose an avatar of either gender, numerous ethnicities, and ones with various sexual orientations, not to mention dwarves, elves, orcs, and so on, has become commonplace online. Maybe it's not a surprise that the stick-in-the-mud Star Wars franchise wasn't quite ready for this at first, but it bungled the job when game developers announced they had added the ability for players to flirt with others of the same gender only on one planet. The planet of, what is it, Makab? Macab? What do you think that is?
I don't know. I don't play the Old Republic.
It was quickly dubbed the Gay Planet, making anti-gay people angry over its existence, while gays and their allies denounced the ghettoization, or ghettoizing, of that option. The game company BioWare intended to expand the option to all other areas of the gaming universe, so it would be at the player's discretion, but now they're in a no-win situation. Big deal or big what, Michael?
It's a big whoop in the scheme of things. It's kind of funny how this sort of thing comes out. You realize now that all the role-playing games online, how they've become a lot more sophisticated from the days of Sims. You know, now all these sort of options or things are out there. They're very common in all these worlds and all these games, so people expect them. And then when you do it and you do it stupidly, it suddenly rebounds back in your face. You're just trying to make some new option available to people, and you think you're doing a good thing. But when you do it in a dumb way, suddenly you look like an idiot and everybody hates you. And that's what you saw here. But it will pass. They'll continue to expand their software and, you know, make these role-playing options available all over the Star Wars universe. And then nobody will think about it twice anymore.
I was like, what, flirt with one another? I thought all you had to do was destroy the asteroids.
Well, exactly. Yeah. We're in the days where you pressed buttons and fired missiles.
Right, exactly. Well, this next story I love. AMC's on-again, off-again crime drama, The Killing, is once again on again. Get it? Once again, on again?
See how I get it.
Okay.
Get it.
The show gained a lot of attention in its first season and then infuriated fans by hinting that a big mystery, which was who killed a certain teenager, a teenage girl, that is, they hinted that it would be solved at the end of the first season, but then they delayed the reveal until the end of the second season, by which time absolutely nobody cared. Netflix was poised to be the savior, since serialized dramas are, in fact, its bread and butter, but the show is coming back via AMC and is already in pre-production. Now it's official. So, big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop.
Okay, then moving on.
I mean, why does anybody care? Why in God's name are they so determined to bring this show back? They screwed the pooch with it. They messed it up creatively. Nobody cares anymore. It's dead in the water. Why they'd actually bring it back for a third season, it just boggles my mind. Maybe they're trying to pretend that they're actually good with creative talent. I don't know.
I don't know either. I asked myself the same question. Well, this next story actually kind of, you know, it's fitting that it show up here while I'm at Sundance. An independent film shingle is back in business. Bob Bernay is relaunching the production company Picture House, a label that was active for a few years in the mid-2000s. He plans to release about 5 to 7 movies a year within, the next 3 years?
Well, he's trying to get up to speed to about 5 to 7 movies a year. You know, the first year, 2 or 3, second 3 or 4, and then ultimately he wants to get to 5 to 7 a year.
Right. Well, the first one will be Metallica Through the Never, which is a fictional film about a roadie working for the famed band that will include the group in the film. Picture House released the Oscar winner Pan's Labyrinth and La Vie en Rose, among many other films. Here's the interesting wrinkle. Picture House has a deal with Netflix. All of its films will be available via Netflix exclusively shortly after their theatrical release. I don't even want to ask this question, but big deal or big whoop, Michael? I know the answer. But
well, I think it's a big whoop. Netflix is the HBO of today. It's the savior for everything. If your TV show is canceled, you go to Netflix. If you want to make a movie and get some back-end money so you can make your slate happen, you go to Netflix. Everybody wants to be in business with Netflix right now, which is kind of fascinating, since remember how they bungled that split between DVD and streaming and how everybody hated Netflix for a while and they were so down on them? Well, now you've got their miniseries launches February 1st. That's House of Cards, the Kevin Spacey miniseries directed by David Fincher. You've got all these deals that they've got going. They're expanding. Everybody wants to be in business with them. Suddenly, they seem like the cool, hip place to be between, you know, that and Arrested Development and all the other deals that they're doing. So it's interesting. You just go back to the story right before with AMC and The Killing. Netflix was the purported savior. You know you're a hot property when everybody is desperate and scared for something and they turn to you as your, you know, your light at the end of the tunnel, the one thing that could make the difference. Everybody thinks Netflix is an important player for years to come. I think that's the message of this. And this is kind of an interesting wrinkle. You make a movie. It used to be you'd have video on demand via cable channels or whatever. In this case, you're doing it via Netflix.
Well, this is what's generally referred to. This is very standard. It's called an output deal. And Every studio has one. DreamWorks, not DreamWorks Animation, but DreamWorks has an output deal. In different countries, they, you know, will have an output deal to the next window, and it goes to premium cable. So that's HBO, Showtime, Cinemax. And so what this does is it makes those players, that playing field, HBO, Showtime, Cinemax, and Netflix. So now Netflix is literally competing directly with HBO and Cinemax and Showtime. There's no getting around it. They are competitors.
But this is an earlier window, though. That's the wrinkle here that's interesting. It's not just that they're going to come to Netflix eventually. They're coming to Netflix before they come out on DVD.
Right. Well, that's while they're
still in theaters. It seems like they're creating art films. Something like La Vie en Rose would not be necessary. I think actually ultimately it was, because it was a relative commercial success and it did win Best Actress. But a lot of the smaller films that they make would not be in 1,000 screens. And so I think the idea is, as with IFC, that you put the movie out and then you immediately have it available streaming video on Netflix, because you figure most people can't get to a theater where it's shown. Just give them that option. If they pay for Netflix, they can watch it.
Yeah, and that's something that HBO can't do. At least, I guess they could HBO Go,
sure.
But yeah.
And I'll say one more thing about this movie, the Metallica film. It's directed by Nimrod Antal. What a great name. But he's a director of a film called Control, which is a movie that I saw back in Cannes in 2003. And I thought he had really good commercial instincts. And I'm happy to see that he's getting his shot at a bigger English language film. But interesting to see if he can cross over to Hollywood.
Apparently, by the way, you shouldn't lie to the FBI. And
really?
I did not learn that in a film up here, although I guess I would have known that anyway. It is a lesson learned by director John McTiernan, however. He was caught up in the wiretapping scandal swirling around private investigator Anthony Pelicano, which was a big deal a few years back in Los Angeles. When questioned by the FBI, McTiernan said, Pelicano, I hardly know him. When what he should have said was, Pelicano, the guy I hired to wiretap and investigate Chuck Roven, the producer on Rollerball? Yeah, I know him. McTiernan pled guilty, then hired new lawyers, and withdrew the plea. A judge agreed McTiernan had received bad advice, but he still faced evidence damning him and was forced to plead guilty again. McTiernan is going to jail for 1 year and paying a $100,000 fine. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop in the scheme of things. Who cares? It's a sordid, not even the end of a scandal, but the sordid latest turn in this Anthony Pelicano scandal, and it's, everybody around it is dirty and, you know, good.
Right. Well, you know, it's a big deal for him.
Again, just don't lie. You look at Martha Stewart, other people. McTiernan would not be in jail if he hadn't lied to the FBI. It's hard, though, when you're trying to hide up illegal acts. It's hard to not lie, isn't it?
Well, I mean, you do. They're basically, you know, punishing you for what is a basic human instinct to protect oneself.
No, they're punishing him for being involved in illegally wiretapping and hiring a guy who was breaking the law to get dirt on other people and doing illegal acts. It's not just because he was a naughty boy.
Well, they say that they're punishing him for lying to the FBI.
Intimidating reporters, scaring them, threatening them physically, wiretapping people's phones. This isn't, you know, oh, he said something not nice. You know, no, they were breaking the law.
On land, on sea, and now by air. Yes, Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg are following up their work for HBO with a third miniseries drawing on the events of World War II. First came Band of Brothers, which focused on the war in Europe and opened with at least 10 million viewers back in 2001, for at least the opening episode had 10 million viewers. Then came The Pacific in 2010, which began with more than 3 million viewers and a lot more options to catch up with episodes in various viewings. Now comes a third miniseries, tentatively called Masters of the Air, about the Air Force and its battle with the Luftwaffe, the German Luftwaffe.
The British might have something to say about that, by the way.
Yeah,
lot of Brits in this movie. That's all I can say.
Graham Yost of the hit show Justified is back on board to pen the scripts. Band of Brothers was 11 hours long and cost $125 million. The Pacific was 10 hours long and cost $200 million. Both were huge critical hits and Emmy winners. What I can't wait for is the Submarine miniseries. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, that's funny you should say that. I think it's a big deal. As soon as they said they're doing a third World War II movie, I immediately thought, all right, they've done Europe. Before I saw what it was about, I thought, my first thought was, I must say, it really was the Air Force, you know, the air battle, because they'd done land and sea. But I also thought, what did you just say? You said the submarine. Well, we've seen that there's not a lot of submarine stories from the American perspective. We all know Das Boot, the classic German film. If you've never seen it, it's a great, great movie about the submarine war from the German perspective. Wonderful film. But my next thought was that they might be doing a movie about the home front, World War II during the home front. Then I thought about prisoners of war and them escaping. Then I thought about the intelligence community and the intelligence war. And then there's the desert war in Africa. So there's no end to the stories you can read about World War II. And I think that would be really rich material for a miniseries. So I wouldn't be shocked if this wasn't the end of the road for these. I'm a little surprised how low Pacific was when it opened up as far as viewers. But I believe these two miniseries, they're very expensive, but they have just been monsters as far as DVD sales and reviewings on HBO, and they're very, very popular. I mean, I think these movies have really made a lot of money for HBO. I don't think it's like a prestige project that they hope to break even on. I would love to see the numbers on them, because I'm pretty sure that they've just been really cash cows for them when it comes right down to it. Because $200 million for a 10-hour miniseries set on the water, that doesn't seem like a lot of money to me. For the sort of the pow that they got out of that. And if you look at this movie, it's set in the air. You're going to have all special effects, guys fighting there. It's going to be even more expensive. You've got to be looking at $250, $300 million.
Well, speaking of big money and raking in the dough, a class action lawsuit has been filed against four major studios over their accounting of profits on home video. Fox, Universal, Paramount, Sony are the studios being sued. When home video turned into a profit center, these studios decided that profit participants would get their percentage cut based on not 100%, but 200% of the actual earnings.
No, 20%, 20%.
Did I say 200%? I meant 20%. Yes.
You could be a studio accountant.
That's true, except they'd fire me on the first day, given that I just gave 200. The studio owes them money now. So if a movie grossed, say, $10 million on video and an actor was due 5% of the gross, the studios decided that they would get 5% of $2 million, which is 20% of the $10 million. That is $100,000 rather than $500,000. Now, this became standard practice, but the artists suing all had contracts and deals from before this became common and insist the studios had no right to determine their cut in this fashion. Can anyone trust anyone in Hollywood? And is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop because it's so common. There are about five stories like this week, and there are every week. And I just wonder, is it ever possible that Hollywood could be so deceptive and so deceitful that it could actually start to harm business? Because every day there's a story of someone who hasn't gotten an accounting statement for 10 or 15 years. They're suing, and they seem to have really strong cases where the studios just fudge the numbers and make stuff up and get away with larceny. And I just wonder, would it ever actually harm? Would people ever say, wait a second, yeah, you can't trust them at all, and actually sort of rebound on them? It doesn't seem to. They just seem to break the law and common sense and get away with it until they're caught, and then they pay up or they take them to court. But I just find it unbelievable.
Well, what you're saying is you're wondering if studios in Hollywood will ever become as reviled as, say, banks or investment bankers.
Exactly.
Apparently, the Weinstein Company has been making action figures for all of Quentin Tarantino's films, which is something I was unaware of. Were you aware of this, Michael?
I was.
Oh, okay. Well, in fact, the action figures for Inglourious Basterds, which we've already mentioned Michael has one of, can currently be purchased on eBay for a cool $300. Well, when the Weinstein Company put action figures on sale for Tarantino's latest movie, the slave western Django Unchained, it caused some mild controversy. A Change.org petition, which racked up 19,000 signatures, asked whether the action figures were appropriate given the subject matter of the film. So rather than deal with the building negative response to the merchandising tie-in, the Weinstein Company just discontinued selling them. Were these action figures trivializing slavery, as some have suggested, and was this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it was a big whoop. To be specific, I joked that I had a Christoph Waltz action figure from Django Unchained, not from Inglourious Basterds. He did play a character in both movies. They've done them for a lot of movies. If you're into this sort of thing, these adult collectibles, they're not for little kids. They're expensive, and they're things that adults use and collect and keep. They're for all sorts of movies, like horror films, sci-fi, spaghetti westerns like this. You can see all sorts of different types of movies that have action figures for them. It's not like little kids playing with Star Wars figurines. That's not the audience for these very expensive products. And it's really a big whoop. And in fact, you're looking at, Jamie Foxx as a hero. You know, he's getting an action figure as a hero. He's not a slave so much as an Avenger getting revenge against slave owners. So I don't see why it's, insensitive to slavery. If it had been the first movie out of all of Tarantino's movies where they suddenly made action figures, I'd still say, well, that's kind of cool. because it is a big market and it's a big, you know, world where people love to collect action figures for prominent movies, and they should just look at it in context and what it is.
You know, speaking of in context, if somebody took just a snippet of, or had just joined us in the moment in time of this show, where you were saying these toys are not meant for kids, these toys are meant for adults to collect,
they would laugh.
Well, I don't know.
But this... Well, you know, I get stuff from Sideshow Collectibles, which is one of the big players in this business. So I'm just very familiar with this world. I've never bought one, but I see them. If you go to a comic book store, and there are a few comic book stores in New York City, like Forbidden Planet, if you go to one of them, you'll always see them behind the glass. So it's just something I've been aware of for a long time. I guess if you've never heard of it and you suddenly say, what? They're making an action figure of a slave? It sounds bizarre and upsetting, but it's not.
Well, this next story is just for you, Michael. Apparently, The Little Mermaid is going to remain flat. And no, I know I was just talking about adult toys, Michael, but that's not some pervy comment on a cartoon character. So get your mind out of the gutter. It's a reference to the fact that Disney has wised up and is canceling the absolutely pointless reissue of The Little Mermaid in 3D. Gee, I wonder what I really think about that. At the same time, the studio is going forward with a far more likely cash cow, The Pirates of the Caribbean. The Johnny Depp franchise just got the green light for a fifth movie due out in 2015. I don't think they have a script, but that's another story. Mind you, the green light didn't come from Disney, which was always eager for another Pirates movie, but it came from Johnny Depp and producer Jerry Bruckheimer, who were the ones that had to decide if they really, really wanted another bucket of money. And if so, where would they put it? I suggest the bathroom right by the you know, scented soaps. So is this canceling of The Little Mermaid in 3D and the revival of Pirates a big deal or a big what, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal for the Disney bottom line in general. I think the 3D canceling is great news. They're realizing it's not worth the money. Though I still think there's value in reissuing their classic animated films as they've done all their lives, despite the fact that movies are widely available on DVD and Blu-ray and streaming. It is still fun to go to a movie and see a classic film. If you have not released The Little Mermaid, you haven't seen it in a theater, it's a movie well worth taking your kids to. Don't waste money on converting it to 3D, because that's stupid. But a small ad campaign, and you put that movie out in theaters in an off season when no other movie is around it, you can make $20, $30, $40 million, just like they did with Monsters, Inc. So I think they were smart to cancel the 3D, but in fact, that history, that tradition, I think is still worth exploring for movies like The Little Mermaid. I think there's no reason why they shouldn't every 7 years try and keep putting them out in theaters and see what happens, because I think there's an audience for that to go out and see them in a theater. It's a different experience. It's a lot of fun. And why not? You don't make it special by turning it into 3D. You make it annoying.
Well, but I know just the man that you can talk to about that. And he
yes.
He is the subject of our Inside Baseball segment this week. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Not necessarily sure how this affects some of our listeners. However,
well, it affects the running of the Disney.
That's true. And that's really, you know, I was joking around that I know a guy that you could talk to over at Disney about releasing The Little Mermaid, but it's Robert Iger. He's the CEO of Disney. And in 2012,
among other things, he has like every title. I think he's the first person who has he's the president, the CEO, the chairman of the board. I literally, when I looked through the list of who had what title over the years at Disney, he has every big title. I think he's the first since Walt to have every single title that you could have as far as at his position. Because Roy Disney Jr. had one of the titles for quite some years. And so even though Michael Eisner and others were very important, they never got that title that Roy had. So Robert Iger is the first one since Walt Disney to have all the big, you know, plates on his desk saying the buck stops here.
Well, the buck did stop there because he got a 20% raise in 2012 and amid a fiscal year when Disney stock, it actually rose some 76%. So if you were an investor in Disney, not a bad investment. He got $2.5 million in salary and the rest, which was, you know, another $27 million in stocks and bonuses, not to mention $500,000 in security and almost $200,000 for travel expenses. Well, he can't necessarily declare travel expenses as income, but there's a huge tax difference between paying tax on $2.5 million as income tax and capital gains tax on $27 million.
Yeah.
So
yeah, how much would he have saved? $27 million taxed at 35% would be
a lot.
Would be $2.589 million. $27 million taxed at 15% is $2.74 million. So he saved about $5 million just on that alone.
Right. Well, in 2010 he earned $30 million, and in 2011 he earned $33 million. So it's a raise.
That's why when I sent him a Christmas card, I included $20 in the, you know, in the envelope, just a little something extra to help him over.
Well, you know, you asked me via email, you know, you thought, well, what do you think of this? You know, it's you know, does he deserve it? But, you know, here's the thing. Disney did hit an overall record in net income. They earned just under $10 billion during 2012, as well as a record net income for all their merchandise, their theme parks, and media companies, but not necessarily from their studio, because we all know they had that big flop, John Carter from Mars.
Right. It was not a peak. Well, they also had very few movies, so it was not a peak year for the film studio, but the other three main divisions did hit their all-time high in record earnings.
But, you know, this is also a year he tied up the Muppets, right? Didn't he finally tie up the Muppets? And he also tied...
That was not this year. That was before that. But
okay.
Yes.
But he tied
it's
up...
during his era, I think.
Yes, Lucasfilm. He bought Lucasfilm for $4 billion. So, you know, he is... And the Avengers made over $1 billion, $1.5 billion.
Right. During the Iger era, which began in 2005, they have broken ground on Shanghai Disney Resort. They acquired Pixar, or frankly, Pixar acquired them creatively for the way it all worked out. They bought Marvel. They bought Lucasfilm. I believe the deal for Muppets was done before the Robert Iger began, before the Robert Iger era began, but I have to look into that. He has spent in the last 7-8 years about $20 billion on those projects alone, on Marvel, Lucasfilm, Pixar, and another theme park resort, which is Shanghai Disney. So those are the big moves that he has made in the era that he's been in charge, which is 2005 to today. If you look at the movies that he's released, 9, 10, 8 movies is typical for his era. 9 movies to 8 movies is the range. Last year, he only released 6 movies, but that was a little unusual. And when you look at 2013, he has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, he has 8 movies scheduled. So he's back to his normal number of about 8 or 9 movies, which is less than one a month, frankly. It's not that many, but they're all, in a lot of ways, big tentpole franchise movies.
Well, and I made the argument that, look, they made $10 billion, and you're paying him, a lot of it based on performance, by the way, you're paying him 0.04% of that. And if it, my feeling is, hey, if they didn't perform, he should not have received the extra amount, and his salary of $2.5 million should have been it, and he would have received 0.0025% of the income instead.
Nobody in charge of a major corporation in America gets $2.7 million a year total compensation. Nobody.
I can't.
So when you're arguing that, well, you know, he wouldn't get all that if he didn't succeed, it doesn't happen. If your company does horrible, they punish you by giving you $8 million or $10 million. I remember back in the day when Lee Iacocca took over General Motors back in the 70s, late 70s, early 80s, he was paid $1 million. And that was headlines around the world. People were shocked. Nobody, they thought, deserved to make $1 million for running a publicly traded company. You're just the head of a company. It's not your own private business. You're just running a business. You've been hired to do a job. And the idea that one person could deserve that much money was unconscionable. And people said, what about the workers? What about the middle management? What about the employees? Today, that would just seem quaint.
But let me ask you this. We've seen specifically in the last 2-3 years, what happens when you get bad management? And specifically, I'm talking about NBC, which had a bad manager for 3 years, and we all saw what happened there.
And who made tons of money.
And who made tons of money.
Bad manager. Made tens of millions of dollars. He wasn't paid, you know, 6 figures, and we'll see how you do.
I'm talking about Ben Silverman.
Yeah, Ben, I thought you were talking about, what's his name?
Jeff Zucker.
From the Today Show.
Yeah, Jeff Zucker.
Yeah, but they were all paid millions of dollars.
Well, and we
good or bad, everybody makes a ton of money if you run a big publicly traded company. Doesn't matter whether you're good or bad, you make a ton of money.
Well, and I'm sure that there are people who would say, well, that's because, you know, in the contract, you have to, you know, if you're going to fail and you're going to fail.
Well,
they
say you can't hire anybody unless you pay them that, because that's what they get somewhere else. We can't get good work. We can't get good help unless you're willing to pay.
Well, I mean, it's true. Silicon
Valley. $40 million. He's been paid $100 million in the past 3 years. Is Disney doing great? Yes. Will it do great without him? Yes. Will it survive? I mean, is he the magic ingredient that Disney can't survive without? Could they find somebody to do it for, say, $50 million over 3 years? $20 million? Do you think maybe there's somebody wildly talented who's been a CEO who could run Disney and do it for $20 million over 3 years? Do you think maybe? It's like winning the lottery.
Well, I'm sure there is, but you saw what happened at at Disney when Rich Ross was in charge.
Yeah, but now you're saying only good. The only way to get good management is to pay them $40 million a year. You can't find somebody to run Disney unless you're willing to pay them $40 million a year. You're just going to get, if you only pay $10 million a year, you're going to get the dregs, the bottom of the barrel. And I think you, Sperling, are ready to be up on the board of directors. Because when you look at who pays these people these salaries, it is the board of directors. And generally, the board of directors are major publicly traded companies. Are friends of the CEO. They're people who run other big companies.
Well, they still have to answer to the shareholders.
They get six-figure incomes to sit on these boards and basically rubber stamp the jobs of the CEO. There's a big push in political circles to try and revamp the board of directors, make them be genuine oversight, make them actually responsible for the decisions that they rubber stamp, make them financially responsible for what happens to the companies, because often you'll see CEOs and people paying themselves huge salaries while they know the company's going bankrupt. In Robert Iger's case, he's actually doing a good job, but that's beside the point. So I wondered, who was the board of directors at Disney? I wonder, who are the people that are saying, let's give him $40 million, such a nice boy, he's doing a good job. And when you look at the list of people, we have a link to it on our website. It's 10 people, including Robert Iger. There are women, there are men, there are Latinos and Blacks and Asians, a whole range of people from across the country and the globe. And they all have specialties in different areas like software and Procter & Gamble.
Coffee.
And the Latino community and finance and you know, creativity circles of the former CEO of Starbucks, all 10 of them, they all have one thing in common. They all agree with you. They all agree with you that they have to pay themselves and each other tens of millions of dollars or they couldn't possibly do the job. They can't get help unless you're willing to pay tens of millions of dollars. They all agree with you that it's crazy. Look, you got to pay this. Look how big the company is. It's making $10 billion a year. How can you expect the CEO to run it and not pay him like a god?
Well, I'm not necessarily saying that you have to. What I'm saying is incentivizing.
If you don't, you're going to get junk.
But what if you incentivize?
Isn't it an incentive to make $5 million a year? That's not an incentive. $8 million a year isn't an incentive. $10 million a year is not an incentive. You're saying if it's $10 million a year, he's going to say that's barely worth getting out of bed.
Well,
really?
I guess.
Really? You think $10 million a year is not incentive?
I would have to say I'd have to put myself in that position and find out who the candidates were. I mean, I'm not in that position. I can't answer that question.
You can answer right now that whether you think $10 million a year is worth getting out of bed and working, doing a good job. Are you going to be half-assed if you're paid $10 million a year? $10 million?
You know, whether I'm half-assed at it or not, it doesn't matter. If I'm not talented at it and I don't know what I'm doing
in
the position.
That's right. That's the other argument. You can't get good talent for less than $40 million. How are you going to find a good CEO for less than $40 million? It can't be done. It isn't done because everybody who's on these companies and these boards serves on other boards and pays all their friends tens of millions of dollars and tells themselves it's not possible. You can't do it otherwise.
Well, you know, I'd actually be very interested to know what our listeners think on this subject.
I would say Robert Iger, unlike a lot of people, has actually done a very good job in the last 5-7 years.
Yes.
We've got a list of the movies coming out in 2013. He's made big, bold moves. I think they will pay off long term. He's got a good lineup of movies next year. They're good lineup commercially, I should say. I'm not actually excited about seeing much of any of them. But commercially, it's a very strong lineup. Iron Man 3, The Lone Ranger, Monsters University, the Cars spinoff Planes, another Thor movie. And the one I'm most interested in creatively, which is Tom Hanks and Emma Thompson starring in Saving Mr. Banks, which is a movie about Walt Disney negotiating with P.L. Travers, the creator of Mary Poppins, for the rights to her novel so he could make the classic animated / live action film Mary Poppins. But, you know, he has done a good job. But the idea that you couldn't possibly find somebody to run a big company who is talented and they certainly wouldn't be bothering to do a good job unless you paid them $30 or $40 million a year, that I take issue with it.
Well, and again, as I was saying, I wonder what our listeners think, and they could let us know if they'd like. They could email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you could call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter. Our username or handle, as they say, is showbizsandbox. We even have a Facebook page where you can like us. Our Facebook page can be found at facebook.com/showbizsandbox. In fact, all of that information, as well as all of the links to stories that we talked about on today's show, and ways to subscribe to us, we really urge you to subscribe to us on iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, or Stitcher. All of that information can be found on our own website, showbizsandbox.com. So please visit showbizsandbox.com, subscribe to the show, rate, review the show, email us, follow us, like us. The music that you hear, the beginning and end of each show, is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website. It changes every week. What is it this week, Michael?
Stingisanidiot.com.
Well, if you happen to visit that website and there's none of Michael's work from the Huffington Post and or other outlets, try michaelgiltz.com. That's another good place to check. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.
I want my MTV.
Where did that come from?
That's Sting singing backup for Dire Straits on Money for Nothing. Ha! to the tune of, you know, that's pretty good, huh?
Yes, it is. And this was going to be the short episode.
It was. It's an hour and a half.